Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a bonus episode.
This is a bonus episode.
We're doing a quick intro.
You've ruined everything.
What? Yeah, it's another hour of the intro. That was just the rehearsal.
Oh, cool.
And now we're going the real
podcast. All right, so try and get it word like by
yeah,
word.
Yeah, word for word. We're going to have a script, a transcript in front of you. So this is ethically ambiguous, but we're going to keep all of that stuff. We should keep it because I think it's kind of funny. Behind the scenes banter. It's a bonus episode of Ethically Ambiguous. We have a guest. We have a very special guest that I am very excited about. Hamid Weinberg. Anna's here with us, and Hamid's here with
Hi.
Us. And we're going to talk about his life as someone that was raised Muslim by a Jewish father and a Christian mother that had converted to Islam, and his life finding comedy and rebelling and so much more. Stay tuned.
Thanks.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Okay, you guys, on this bonus episode of Ethnically Ambiguous, I am so excited because this is a guest that I've wanted to have on for, like, since we had this podcast created, honestly. And he's finally here, and it's Ahmed Weinberg!
Yeah. Sorry, I'm sick, but yeah.
I remember, so Anna and I...
I'm also here.
Yeah, Anna's here. But she used to produce comedy shows, and I would take photos for her. And you were one of the first people I like really liked that I saw doing comedy in L.A.
Whoa.
Like, at the Comedy Palace. I don't know if you remember that venue. It was, like, in the top of the Chinese
Theater.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, and I...
R.I.P.
Yeah, I know. It's a great venue that is not here anymore. But, yeah, you're hilarious. And
Thanks.
My mom likes you, so I know that you're halal.
That's so interesting because like your mom's like traditional.
No, I mean she used to cover her hair. She's kind of liberal now, but
yeah.
She has good taste. I was just kidding. She's just when I told her that I was gonna have you on the show, she was just like my cool points in her mind skyrocketed. She was like, "You know him?" And I was like, "Just calm down." She'll Whoa. Like even when I'm working, she'll send me your like Ramadan videos or like whatever, and I'll be like, "Yeah, okay, I've seen these." She's like, "But have you seen all of them?" Like, my mom is your biggest fan.
Sometimes I think I made that web series just for like moms
mm-hmm.
to be like,
"Oh, he's a good Muslim boy."
Oh, and there's good content in Hollywood. The Muslims have a chance, and
my mother was like, "Oh, pass."
No, really?
She didn't see it. She doesn't watch anything fun.
Well, some Muslims, like especially on YouTube comments, are like, "Oh, this isn't Islam.
What?
He's not a real Muslim."
Wait, why would they say that?
I don't know. Maybe just because I'm dating in the web series,
right?
Right.
But I mean, the if someone's closed-minded about that, that's not really Islam. That's just like their warped version of that religion. You know what I mean? Like, if someone's like, no, because a lot of Muslims are like, no music, no this, no that.
Yeah.
Like, and I think in every religion, people just like make it their own.
But that's how I was raised. Like, I get it because my mom was super strict.
Yeah.
So well, I couldn't listen to music and I couldn't date and all this stuff that
I'm
like,
still not allowed to date. I have to get engaged first.
Really?
Yeah.
That's well, a weird
app. I'm not gonna get married. That's just, I've resolved that.
How's your mom feel about that?
She's sad. Mm. She wants to have little grandkids.
My sister just got engaged, so I think my mom. Really?
Yeah, my older sister. She's a year and a half older than me. She's a doctor. She got engaged to a doctor. She's all set. Yes. She's the one that's doing whatever they want, and I'm just hiding in the shadow.
As long as one person in the family is like doing it,
exactly. The I rest feel of the us, pressure a little bit lessened.
We can just do heroin or whatever.
Is your sister also?
That's the way it goes.
Yeah, I know. Is your sister also still Muslim?
I don't know if she would identify as Muslim, but like we were raised in like a very hippie, Sufi.
Can you explain that a little bit? Because your last name is Weinberg.
Yes.
And I remember, no, not sorry. I remember a big part of the first bit I saw you do. I remember a bit that you would do is like, I'm Muslim, but my name is Jewish. I'm butchering it. You had like a way of saying it that was really
funny.
That's
the joke. I'm Muslim, but my name is Jewish. Yeah. I'm butchering it.
No, that's not what it is. Wait.
That's hilarious.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Because my dad was raised Jewish culturally. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had a bar mitzvah, but he's from Brooklyn and very like chill, cool dad, cool mom. And my mom was raised Irish Catholic.
Okay.
She was one of 10 children. It's all in the web series, folks. Lord.
But okay, but our listeners are getting introduced to you now.
Right.
So I want to just get a little backstory on you. Also, I should have asked before we started rolling, but is there anything that's off limits? And I can cut this part out if there is.
Oh, I don't think so. No.
You're an open book?
Yeah.
Word.
I mean, maybe I'll tell you to cut something after.
Okay.
And they'll never know.
Okay, they'll never know.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you want us to cut this?
Please cut all of it.
Yeah, okay. Cut the whole pod.
This has all been cut.
Thank you.
Well, how did your parents meet?
So, yeah, they both kind of went on their own spiritual journeys, I would say. Mm-hmm. Like, my mom wasn't really into the Catholicism thing, but her upbringing was really intense, as far as I can tell. Like, 10 kids, military dad, like, he was in the Air Force, so they were constantly moving from base to base, like, mm-hmm. army brat lifestyle. Oof. And very strict household, a lot of booze, and like that kind of, I think, just turned my mom away from Catholicism. But she did feel very like spiritual. Mm-hmm. She wanted to be like a God person.
Right.
So she eventually ended up finding a guru in Philadelphia who's like a Sufi Muslim. And Sufism is like a mystical branch mm-hmm. of Islam. And but between that and her childhood, she like lived with Native Americans for a while and was like, she also only ate sprouts that she grew in the back of her car.
Wow.
Back of her car?
She had, yeah. When my mom was young, she got in a car accident. Mm-hmm. The whole family did. So she had like some money to burn. And so she was able to just like live this hippie life where she.
It's kind of beautiful.
Yeah. It's, the American dream.
Yeah.
Get in a car accident that doesn't destroy you.
Yeah, and then just reap the benefits of all
and then just do whatever you want. Yeah. So she like, she grew sprouts in the back of her Volkswagen Bug and traveled around the country, lived with Native Americans for a while, and then eventually found this guru in Philadelphia. And she said that she had been hearing his voice in her head like for a while,
whoa.
But she didn't know who it was.
Wow.
It was like this voice telling her to come home.
That's heady.
But it wasn't her dad's voice, you know. So she didn't know what it was.
Whoa.
And then when she, it was this community, it was actually a Jewish community center in Philadelphia that had been converted to facilitate this guru and his followers.
Huh.
So what used to be a JCC was now like a Sufi Muslim.
Wow.
Commune almost, where the guru lived and all of his disciples would be there every day, and a lot of them lived there.
Yeah.
So when my mom finally lived there, she lived in a room with like 19 other women that were also disciples, and they all like slept on the floor and it was just full-time disciple.
Yeah.
Like
that was her life.
That was her life. Yeah, yeah. Cooking food with the guru, and the guru would give discourses, and they would go kind of on random trips, like to the zoo and do fun stuff. But it was also like very much like meditation focused. Mm-hmm. Zikr. Zikr is like this Sufi meditation where you like repeat the names of God over and over and over, almost as if they're mantras.
Yeah. In Arabic, zikr means like memory. Like, to remember.
Yeah, it's all about like remembering God all day. Mm-hmm. So like every breath you're supposed to be.
So that's when she really got into Islam, and like she got introduced to it, I guess.
Yeah, I think that like her desire to be religious kind of suddenly found this perfect path. Mm-hmm. She was like, oh, I'm going to be a Muslim. I don't know if she said that.
But... Yeah. How did she meet your dad?
My dad was a disciple there too.
Oh, whoa.
And my dad lived in the boys' room where all the boys' men lived.
Yeah.
And my mom lived in the girls' room, and they were both disciples. So it was like this big community of people just like hanging out, doing guru stuff, going to Sri Lanka where the guru was from. And yeah, it was like a bunch of people. It was very sober and very like, I don't know, very progressive, because the guru's conversations or his discourses were always about how like religion is actually one of the evils of the world. Mm-hmm. So he drew this following that was very like cool and progressive.
Yeah.
And then one day he was like, oh, we're going to build a mosque. Uh-huh. And a lot of people were like, wait, what? I thought this was beyond religion.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, it's actually like Islam is beyond religion. Like if you actually get to the root of it, it's just about truth, and it contains all the rest of the religions within it and transcends any sort of thing. And then the mosque is also like for people who want that, you know. I don't think he would ever tell people you have to do this. I don't know, but
that's the big difference I feel like with Islam and a lot of other religions, especially like Christian based faiths, is like you don't see Muslims like knocking on doors being like, come join us, you know what I mean? It's not like, like, they're more like, if you want to come, you can come, kind of thing.
Totally. Well, like, Jehovah's Witnesses would come to my house, and my mom would invite them in, and they would leave with literature. Like, my mom would give them a bunch of, like, pamphlets from our guru. She just, like, loved talking to anyone about it.
So you know how your mom got into the community. The community. How did your dad get into it?
My dad... Yeah, raised in Brooklyn, and when his parents got a divorce, it was really tough. He had to live with his mom in Cambridge, Massachusetts for a lot of the time, and she was a real hippie. She wouldn't mind me saying. She also had a stroke, so she won't hear this maybe.
Yeah, okay.
Not a huge podcaster after the stroke?
After the stroke, no. It's kind of... But she, like, moved to Cambridge... Her boyfriend's name was Gandalf. Wow. It was a real hippie scene, as far as I can tell. Wow. And now she, after the stroke, like, she'll talk about it, but just in these sound bites. Uh-huh. She'll be like, I smoked a lot of pot. And she'll just say that kind of thing. She'll be like, I was a hippie, you know? But she doesn't want to talk about it because, you know, a lot of drugs around. And my dad was in this house in Cambridge that was kind of some sort of community center for the hippie scene there. So there would be lots of people kind of like crashing all the time, and there were some kind of criminal types or just weird people.
Yeah.
And my dad was exposed to lots of psychedelics when he was really young. And he was doing that at like a young age and had some bad experiences. And I think that his mom realized that like maybe his life would be better outside of this world. So she had heard about the same guru through a friend and like brought my dad to Philadelphia, and I think my dad just fell in love with this community. A lot of cool people there, you know, like if you can imagine like young progressives who are just like, we found this guru and we're all like gonna be disciples, and like how cool is that? We're gonna like reach enlightenment and focus on this instead of drugs and whatever else was going on.
Was there any rules about any of them like getting together, like your mom and dad, or was that cool? Like they were just that progressive?
It wasn't, yeah, there wasn't dating. Mm-hmm. I mean, there probably was behind the scenes, who knows, but the guru was all about like getting people married.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if people seem to be interested in each other and you would kind of go on a couple walks and then be like, all right, I think we're getting married.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
That easy. Shereen,
is that what you go on a walk? Wait, so is that what happened with your parents? They went on a couple walks and then they were like, let's do this?
My dad wanted to marry my dad's 10 years younger than my mom, and he wanted to marry her, and she was kind of like, oh, this kid wants to marry me. This weird Jewish guy is like,
how old was your dad?
Hit me up. That's a good question. I don't know, because I think he was 24 when he had me.
Okay.
You know, so my mom was like 35, so... they probably got married when, you know, he was 23, around that time. But, you know, 23 to 40, or 23 to 33, mm-hmm. that's a lot of
growing. A lot of growth happens between that time.
Yeah. So I can't imagine. I mean, I'm 29, and I don't know if I could.
You'd have already been married to a woman who's 10 years old, and you had a little Ahmed.
I won't name my kid Ahmed.
Another Ahmed
I can't
Weinberg
do
the
that.
Second. Well, so you were raised Muslim. That's all you've like really known as far as like, because your parents were both converted when they had you.
Yeah. Well, no, they converted before, you know, because they were part of this community. Yeah. So that's how they met. They converted to Islam. They got married. They had me after they got married, after the guru died.
Oh.
So the guru died in 86 and I was born in 89. Mm. You know, so like I grew up in the fellowship, which is like what the community is called. I grew up in that JCC.
Whoa.
Like literally in the guru's house in this one. It was a studio apartment. And like that's where my parents lived and that's where I lived. And I had a little bed in the corner and they slept on the fold out couch. And yeah, my dad was working in IT. So like he had a job, but my mom was just full time, you know, parent and also being like a person at this community center, like every night there's a meal and it's free for whoever wants, and there's also like they play tapes of the guru's discourses because they recorded so many hours of it, so there's like meetings and it's all kind of very like communal and chill. They even have Christmas dinner and
That's
stuff
nice.
Like that. Yeah.
What did they do after the guru died? Did anyone else kind of slowly take over or?
No, like he had put in place some sort of mini government there there was like a board that are still in charge of making bigger decisions. And
Interesting. And it's still over there, that community?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So being raised in that, though, were you always like, this is cool? Or was any part of you like, this is strange?
I mean, you know, when you're a kid and you're growing up and there's people around all the time, like there were always people in this community center where I lived.
Were there a lot of kids?
Yeah, a lot of the guru's disciples had kids at the same time.
Okay.
So there was like, I don't know, 12 kids my age who were my friends, and none of them lived there. You know, that was like the big difference. Like they all, their parents had houses nearby, and I grew up in this center, in the mosque. Like every morning my mom would like wake me up for prayers, and I would walk downstairs and then upstairs in the mosque. And it was like growing up in the mosque, basically.
Yeah.
And that was like a very cool experience as a kid, because my friends were always coming to my house like on Saturday or Sunday for the meetings. And so I didn't have to go anywhere on the weekends, which was cool. And it was all very fun. As I grew older, like it got a little more complicated. But my sister was born when I was 5 or 6. And then we moved to a house that's like around the corner.
Mm.
So we live on the same block still as that center. But I grew up in a house from that point on. And I went to a Muslim school when I was a kid. And then in second grade, I went to an all-boys private school. And that was like a huge shift in my life. Because then suddenly I felt like way different.
What are Muslim schools like? Do you know of that?
Yeah, I went to Muslim school when I was younger.
You did?
But it was like a full-time school?
Yeah, I went to my kindergarten and a little bit of first grade and preschool. I was in
I didn't know that was a thing.
Was it a mosque for us? Was it in a mosque for you?
No, it was in South Philly, in like this really bad neighborhood.
Yeah, we had uniforms. It was like Quran study and like, I don't know, Arabic. And
it was,
I mean, there was actually school too, like math and everything, but a big portion was like Muslim
study. It's
like
religious stuff.
My grandma was a teacher at the school. Oh. It's all coming back to me.
Whoa.
Yeah, because she was a teacher. So like she got a job there at this Muslim school. Whoa. And there were other people from the guru's community that worked there too.
Wait, so what did your parents' families think of your parents converting to Islam? Since your mom was raised Catholic and your dad was Jewish culturally?
My mom's parents were, I think, probably weary at first, I'm sure. I don't know any more weary than, oh, you know, she's in a Native American tribe or like whatever. It seemed like maybe another thing. But then once she was getting married and she was like, this is my life. My grandfather on my mom's side like came to the wedding and met the guru before that. And had, I think my mom said he's, you know, he was approved of it. Ooh. It was like, this is a man of peace, you know, and gave his blessing. Mm-hmm. So
can I ask where they got your name? Do you know where they got your name? Like why they chose Ahmed?
Ahmed is, well, the guru's from Sri Lanka. So like it's different than an Arabic version of Muhammad, which is Ahmed or, you know, it's different because Tamil has different whatever. Letters. I don't know. So my name is Ahmed, which is pretty common in Sri Lanka. And it's just another root of Muhammad, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but nobody knows
my name. Knows that, yeah.
People hate it. I mean, especially...
Well, do you hate it?
No, I don't. Not at all.
Did you used to?
No. I never really felt weird about my name.
Yeah.
I just felt weird about being different.
Mm. What about... What? How did you know you were different?
Because I was the only one fasting in my entire school. Like, I was the only Muslim there.
In the private school you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. And I was the only, like, I don't know. It just felt like I wanted to be normal. Like, the school was just Christian and Jewish, and America is very not a Muslim country as far as, like, culturally. And you don't even think about it, but it's like, oh, yeah, there's nowhere to pray.
Yeah.
Like if America was a Muslim country, there would be like little rooms where you could go and do your prayers five times a day. Or even in the airports, there's churches now.
Yeah.
And like in malls, there's churches. And there's just churches. And then Judaism has, of course, smaller but like very like communal clusters all around the country. But like, and Islam does too. And there's mosques all over. But it just feels less... I don't know, accepted or...
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always surprised when I see, like, a prayer room.
Yeah.
Because it's like my mom, who prays five times a day, her ability to find places to pray is amazing. She is just so... She'll be like, BRB.
She scouts it out.
Yeah, like, she knows everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, she'll be like, I'm going to just take some clothes in the dressing room. I'll be right back. It's like, I know she's not trying anything on. Yeah. I know she's just praying really quickly and then coming back. Yeah. Or she'll just be like... I'm going to put the seat in the back down in the car. You can go do whatever you need and be back in five.
Oh, yeah.
Like cars are a big one. Yeah.
My mom's always praying in the car.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be, like, listening to music and then turn, and she's, like, got her hands on her stomach, and she's just, like, kind of
nodding
her head, and I'm like, oh, there she goes. Yeah. She didn't even let us. She was, no, she was just, she just went for it.
Yeah. I just remember, in school, I would always get so, I would always feel so left out because, like, Christian holidays were, like, always a thing. Jewish holidays were always a thing. And then, like, we would have Eid or Ramadan or anything, and no one would even acknowledge it in public school. Like, it was just, like, another day.
I got to stay home for certain New Year's, like religious or an Iranian New Year and Eid. I got to stay home for the day my parents
There were some
let
days
me.
That my parents took me out of school for Eid, but for the most part, like, I just wanted people to like know that like there was a thing going on at school, like
or even in
like the calendars that we would get, it always marks like Hanukkah starts or like Christmas Day, and it's like what about the other ones? Like what if I always felt like so I don't know like an alien. Like
it's not worth the price of ink even.
Yeah, it's really not.
I got to stay home for Eid, and it was always like. Fun, but then I like missed a day of school.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, catch up. I had to catch up.
That's the thing. Like, I wish it was just like the same way that Christmas is off. Like, we just have it off. I don't know. But we're going to get more into it after a quick commercial break.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season remind us to embrace change and fearlessly look toward the future. Like Andrew Jarecki, award-winning filmmaker and creator of Movie Phone.
The studios didn't really control the theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry.
Or Kellen Kenny, Chief Marketing and Growth Officer at AT&T, who installed fiber in customers' houses rather than leading from afar.
It is so crucial that you spend time with the customers. That is the best lesson.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Wow, yeah, that was so intense.
Thank you so much. What was I going to ask you? When did you know that you wanted to do comedy?
I felt like I was funny when I was a kid. Like maybe peak funniness when I was young.
Okay.
And I was always just, I don't know. I could, even when I went to this school, like that was my tool.
Mm-hmm.
Was like, I don't really fit in here maybe and I feel weird, but I'm going to just be weird and wacky. And I made friends quickly because of that. So that was always a thing in my life. And then in sixth grade, I was still at the same private school, and my friend signed me up to do a talent show, and he just signed me up to do stand-up.
Whoa.
Which was not something I had ever wanted to do. I didn't even like stand-up.
Is this friend a fairy godmother, or like, what is this friend?
Well, his name's Christian.
Whoa.
When I went to this school, second grade, I was there second grade through 12th grade. Like second grade, my best friend immediately was this kid, Christian.
Mm-hmm.
We were just obsessed with drawing cartoons together.
No.
And we'd get in trouble because we weren't paying attention in class or anything. We were just like instantly best friends, drawing cartoons constantly.
Christian and Ahmed.
Yeah. Pretty magical when you think about it. And now it's, was that a fart?
What was that?
I have no idea. In that room?
That's just a cool. Fat
Can we
fart.
Keep that?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Keep it in. Yeah.
Keep the fart, please.
Keep the fart, yeah.
It'd be funny if I farted and I just
You're like,
did
what
that.
What was that?
Wait, was that a fart? Can you guys hear that? That's such a good defense mechanism for loud farts. Just like... Did you guys hear that fart? That was a really loud fart.
That was a really loud fart.
I think I did that.
Yeah. Do you feel
did
that?
You
it was like vibrating the room. Yeah.
I don't know what that was, but it sounded like a
On
weird
a bus. Like... I'm like, did you guys hear that?
Everyone's like, we don't know you.
Wait, so tell me more about Christian signing up for this talent show.
Christian signed me up. I was like, yeah, I didn't know what stand-up was, you know, but I thought, yeah, sure, I'll do it. And my school, we had our assembly in a, it was kind of felt like a church, you know? It was like this big assembly room that was all wood and piers and... Oh. Yeah, it was really beautiful. Stained glass windows.
Oh, it was a church.
I guess it was a church.
That sounds like a church.
Yeah, it was a big Jesus on the wall.
Yeah, there's a crucifix.
And there's a priest.
Like a
and, I don't know. It's kind of like a church.
There
I guess.
Was like some benches and like whatever. Like a pew.
There's pubes everywhere. Pew, it was kind of like a church.
There are pubes.
Yeah, you know how a church has pubes.
Everywhere randomly. Yeah.
Yeah, and we all got baptized, and it was kind of like a church.
There was a pastor and a minister.
A guy who's in complete denial that he's in a church.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then I did it. I did this talent show, and it was I was chubby and awkward, and I had a big red afro, and I don't know. I felt, like, intimidated by, like, the older, cooler kids. Mm-hmm. Mm. My dad helped me write these jokes for it.
Uh-oh, so they were all dad jokes?
No, because my dad has a good sense of humor. My dad's favorite comics are like Stephen Wright.
Oh, wow.
And
that's cool.
Yeah, kind of like deeper cuts.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, shit. Okay, Dad.
Yeah.
And so my dad helped me write these jokes, and they were like, my name's Ahmed Weinberg. I'm half Jewish and half Muslim. You think you've got problems? I'm at a holy war with myself.
That's some deep shit for a kid.
I feel
to
like
say.
You still use this material.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my opener.
Does your dad write your material still?
He should.
Yeah.
My new shit is so bad.
No.
My dad's always like, so what are you working on? Like, what jokes are you? I'm like, you're not going to punch up my material. I'm 29 years old.
He's like, all right, so here's what I'm thinking for that tag. Like, okay.
So, yeah, this airplane joke needs work. So it went really well.
That's amazing.
It was crazy. I remember being so, like, unaware that I was even on stage. That's how nervous I was.
Yeah.
Like, blackout nervous. And just probably added to why it was so funny, because I just stood there and said these jokes in a monotone, weird voice and probably held the microphone wrong. But it killed. And I didn't know what that joke meant at all. I don't know what a holy war was. I don't think anyone in the audience did. But it just...
It was a joke for the parents.
Sense. Killed because of who I was and how awkward it was.
Brought the house down.
Yeah. And I had some other jokes that I wrote. Myself.
Okay, like what?
I wrote this joke that was like, teachers say books are your best friends, but that's because they have the books with all the answers in them. That was a pretty good joke.
Yeah, we laughed.
You guys laughed.
Yeah.
I think I had a joke about cereal, about how annoying it is to pour cereal in and then you don't have milk. So you have to get the cereal back in the bag. Which you have to like rip it open. I don't know. It was something about cereal.
Relatable material.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, what do kids like? Cereal.
The best jokes I've ever written, come to think of it. Wow.
Wait, so if you were so nervous, but when you left the stage, were you like, I think I want to keep doing that?
I just remember older kids being like, hey, like that was so funny, you know? And I was in the yearbook.
Oh, nice.
And, like, my picture was big in the talent show page. Funny guy. Yeah, it was like, oh, shit, Ahmed's funny. I don't know what. It just, something clicked.
Yeah.
And from that point on, it was always in the back of my head, like, this is what I'm going to do. And I did it at the talent show again, I think, seventh grade.
Mm-hmm.
Did fine. I don't remember if I did it in eighth grade, but it was just something in the back of my head where I thought, I suck at sports. I'm fine at school.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a thing I cared about. If I wanted to get straight A's, I could have, but I just didn't care enough.
Yeah.
So it felt like comedy was, oh, I can be smart, mm-hmm. and it's cool, and it's fun. And it just clicked. So then once I graduated, oh, and then in high school, there was this, we had a...
Were you still in private school this whole time?
Yeah.
Throughout high school too?
Yeah.
Well,
all boys private school. But then in high school, there was an all-girls school down the street, and we combined classes, and it was so awkward.
Like the first time ever there's a girl in your class, you're just like, oh, hi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm like, I've masturbated to the thought of this. Now that I'm here, it's terrible. And now I'm like, yeah, my mom was super sexually repressive also. Mm-hmm. So then suddenly there's women around. I was like really excited because I could be friends with them, but then I didn't know how to turn it into anything else,
right.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I was a virgin until I was 22, I think.
As you should be.
Yes.
Were you married?
No. I.
Oh.
Sorry.
You said that so nervously. Like, wait.
Yeah.
Was I married when
it? Was this a joke?
No, I was just joking. Because I'm a very conservative Muslim
religious
woman, so.
Yeah,
oh, no.
I can tell.
Yeah.
By the full hijab.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but I mean, I think it's a trend that Muslim kids or like kids that are raised Muslim kind of like are sexually late to the game.
Oh, definitely.
Because I definitely was. Like, it's just, I think, because I didn't lose my virginity until I was 24.
Well, you're 24. Told not to acknowledge your body for a very long time.
I was disgusted with my body. I was like, this is not, I don't want anyone to see this.
Mm-hmm.
I felt weird about the whole thing.
Yeah.
My dick. I don't know. I was like, that's
a thing I'm going to ignore forever. That's what I felt about my vagina. I was like, no, that's just not going to happen.
I was really excited for my pubes. When my pubes came in, I was like, hell yeah.
What?
I'm a real man now.
Yeah.
Got my pubes.
Got my pubes. This is a regular church down here.
Wait, so did your parents know that you were thinking about doing comedy like as a career?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't until college. Okay, so I graduated high school and I did an open mic in Philly at this comedy club, and it was like a full room. And I had to go first. And I did that same set from sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure.
You're like, it killed like, back
if
then.
It doesn't work. I remember like I was like, I'm gonna write new jokes, and then you get this thing where you're like, no, I'll just do what works.
Yeah.
As soon as you're backstage at a comedy club, you're like, okay, I'll just do what works. So then I just like had a good set again,
mm-hmm.
you know? And in my mind, I'm like, I'm a fucking good comic. I don't know why. I had luck.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. Because looking back, I sucked. But I just ended up in these circumstances.
Yeah.
So then I went to the University of Vermont for 2 years, and there was a tiny little comedy scene up there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a comedy competition, or it was something, where it was like Vermont's funniest.
Mm-hmm.
And I auditioned and had another good set.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And then I was competing in this competition. That was in front of like 300 people.
Whoa.
And I did fine. And I still have a video of it that makes me cringe so hard. It's so bad. I mean, it's so bad. Now I look back and I'm like, I think those audiences were so dumb. That's what it was. I wasn't lucky. I just like ended up in front of the dumbest people in the world.
Who
didn't know what
studying
comedy was. Film theory.
Interesting.
I went to UVM because I wanted to get away from like, I just felt weirdly repressed by my background and was like, who am I outside of this? So then I went far away and was like, I'm going to get drunk a lot. Yeah. Go snowboarding.
In Vermont woods.
Lose my virginity, yeah. You know, in the woods.
And be a man with my pubes.
With my pubes. And I'm going to get real Jewish and eat a girl out. And that's going to be exciting. Jews eat
Do out. They?
Yeah.
That's the thing?
I do think probably Jewish men are probably the best lovers.
Whoa.
Wow.
A little bit biased, maybe, you think that way because you're half?
I mean, I just
Are
think...
you pushing your bias on us?
I don't know, because I think it has a lot to do with the nurturing mother.
Oh, okay.
So you're a real giver in bed. Like, other religions, the mother is kind of not the most nurturing thing, typically. So
That's
think...
why I'm not giving it all. I'm just a really cold shrewd in bed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Muslims suck in bed.
We're all just like,
well,
I don't
half,
think there is
so
a stereotype about Muslims in
bed. No, I don't think so either. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe there is just like being an experience because like a lot of parents or like a lot of traditional people will only have sex with the person they're married to. So
and
I
it's
think,
mostly just for kids.
Yeah,
and then there's
it's like a duty. Like there's no like sexual like fun times in the Muslim community. It's just like
I mean, my mom was repressive to the like we would watch movies, and if there was a sex scene, it would be like, oh my god.
Oh no, we
like,
did not.
My mom would be like, Jeff, what is happening?
And Jeff,
that's my dad.
I know, it just sounds so strange when you say it that way.
Like have to fast forward.
Oh, no,
yeah,
no,
our
my,
TV was
my
named
dad
Jeff.
Would just my dad would just turn off the TV. I didn't know Titanic. Do you know that Titanic scene where it's like drawing like one of your French girls? I didn't know that was from Titanic until I was like 20 because the version that we saw at home was censored. Like that scene was cut out.
Oh wow.
We never saw any nudity.
Wait, you guys had like an edited version?
My dad's friend did. My dad's friend did, and we watched it like at his house, and we saw the whole thing, and I was like, okay, cool. And then like later on in life, I kept seeing that meme like drawing like when you're French girls, and I'm like, what is that? Like, why are people? I don't understand this joke. Like it's from Titanic. I don't remember that. And then like I realized I had seen like a butchered version of Titanic.
Whoa, are there like underground Muslim copies
you know
of movies?
You know there are. You know there are. Of course, there's always one guy who's like the tech guy who just knows how to do these things, and then everyone
and distributes to every family, every father that's like, I need one of those. My daughters are growing up.
That's so funny. It's like vital information for the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh, so now they're married. Interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
I guess we missed that whole part where they liked each other.
No. That's my dad would always be like, all right, cover your eyes. And then all the kids would just be like.
My dad would look over too. He's like, are you guys looking? Like,
yeah.
Like making
like,
sure
okay,
we're not
you
peeking.
Can uncover your eyes.
And we'd be like, yeah. Or he would just turn off the TV sometimes. And even like now he will do it. When we're at home like watching a movie and he'll like someone will be having sex and my dad will just turn off the TV and I'm like, I'm almost 30. Like, let me live.
That's great. Yeah. We just taunt my dad. We're like, oh. And my dad's like, what? Oh, okay. Now we just make fun of him. Like, Dad, do you see the boobies on TV? And he's just like, hey.
It's especially weird because, like, lot of nudity that's accepted on television is usually female nudity. And, like, I have that body. Like, it's not like it's, like, the first time I've ever seen boobs. And my dad's like, don't look. I'm like, I know what that is.
Yeah, you can go in your room and watch that scene.
On your phone.
Or, yeah, in the mirror.
Yeah, I know. The options are endless.
But my mom would just be fine with violence. It's just that classic thing, you know?
Yeah, I think American culture is like that,
Yeah, it's not a Muslim thing.
It's American culture.
Yeah. I was watching Adam Ruins Everything last night about Hollywood and about the rating system.
Mm. The rating system is fucked.
It's crazy because nobody knows who does it. It's like a...
Is it like MPAA, TTCC?
No, but the people who decide are like a bunch of parents who live in Hollywood who are pretty homophobic.
Yeah.
Because like... Really? Yeah, you can say fuck as long as it's men and women like...
Oh.
You can say fuck you and it's PG-13. If you say I want to fuck you, then it's R.
Whoa.
Because then it becomes sexual.
Right, I heard you can have one fuck and PG-13, and then if there's any more, it turns into an R.
No, but if it's like a sexual fuck.
Oh, it's just automatically.
Then it's R.
But the thing is, only in the US, not only, but in Europe, the rating system is by violence. In the US, it's by sex, it's like sexuality. Like in Europe, the rating is by like how violent something is.
Yeah.
And that's how it should be. Like we shouldn't be like, no, people can't have sex and then like just think it's like this like repressed thing and then have boys like have all those like toxic like ideas about like sex. And then in I don't know. It makes more sense to have violence. And then we have like all these gun shootings here. Like, why do you think that is? He glorifies it, you know, in film.
I don't know. But Michael Moore, I mean, he covered this. Yeah,
he did. He did.
Bowling for Columbine, yeah. For some reason, is still the only movie I talk about.
It's a good movie.
Something I've noticed about you.
Yeah, sorry. So my Muslim background's interesting, but also Bowling for Columbine. But in Canada, like, their media is just as violent, but for some reason, there's not as much gun death there.
Yeah.
And they were saying, I think Michael Moore's point was like, it's because the news isn't as negative in Canada.
Is that what was that his point?
I thought he kind of didn't figure it out. He was like, I guess it's because they don't lock their doors.
We can't just put it all on him, right, to figure it out. But he tried.
He tried. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for these icebreakers.
Yeah, we can just have the whole thing.
Take it home.
Yeah.
Ah. Well, I hope you did fuck in Vermont. And on that note, we're going to take a quick commercial break.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season remind us to embrace change and fearlessly look toward the future. Like Andrew Jarecki, award-winning filmmaker and creator of Movie Phone.
The studios didn't really control the theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry.
Or Kellen Kenney, Chief Marketing and Growth Officer at AT&T, who installed fiber in customers' houses rather than leading from afar.
It is so crucial that you spend time with the customers. That is the best lesson.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
And we're back to hear if he fucked in Vermont.
Well,
I didn't.
No,
you what? Didn't? want to build up to nothing.
Fucking leave.
I could have, but
you
I
go
didn't.
And you fuck in Vermont. Then you come back and we finish the show.
Okay, my dating, my childhood dating experience. My first girlfriend's name was Halima Freudberg.
Well, what? You found one just like you.
Well, she was in my community. There were all these Jewy Muslim names.
Oh, interesting.
In this community. I don't know if I can legally say
so you're
them.
Not the only one. We thought you were the only one
no,
out
no,
there.
No. There's a whole bunch.
Oh, wow.
You could have a huge podcast.
You literally came from that community.
Yeah, exactly. Like, her father's name was Malik Freudberg.
Whoa.
Wow.
Like, my friend's name's, like, Asia Applebaum.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's cool.
But my friend's... Their parents weren't as mean, so their names were Noah, like Isaac. You know, my parents were like, "You're a hobbit. You have zero career
options.
Your
dad's Jeff, but you're a hobbit."
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can be an author or a comic. That's it.
Yeah, yeah, or like a professor.
A professor.
And like a very like niche, like culture, subculture topic.
Maybe it was just a... I don't know. Maybe this is a conspiracy theory, but they just wanted me to stay home.
Yeah, they're like, you can never leave.
They're like, you won't fit in anywhere with
this
name.
You won't feel comfortable anywhere you go. Like, you're going to be forced to stay here and be with us forever. I did want to ask you something. So I was raised Muslim, and I feel like because my dad was kind of really strict on a lot of things, and my mom was too at a certain point, but I kind of like despised it for a long time, and I like hated all kinds of religion. I hated like trying like just someone telling me what to do. But you are still you still fast, and you still like consider yourself a Muslim. So I want to ask if there was ever a point that you were like, I don't want to, I'm not a Muslim, or like I reject this. And I, because you said that you wanted to go to Vermont and like fuck and like like drink and whatever. So like, was that you trying to be like, I'm gonna discover myself and like whatever?
I think, yeah, when I was young, I didn't want to be a part of it, like, just because it made me feel different. So I would be, you know, in high school, I was, like, going out and drinking, and I got arrested twice.
Really?
Oh, wow. And that was, like, the big turning point for my parents to be like, oh, shit, this kid is, like, in trouble.
Uh-huh.
Because I was just going out and drinking every weekend, and I had to lie about it because I couldn't be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would get in trouble, and it would be like this huge shock surprise. And it sucked. And my dad would be very upset, you know, finding like weed in my room and stuff like that, because he came from this drug-heavy childhood and like didn't want me to do drugs. It was like everything they didn't want me to do, obviously, that's exactly what I'm interested in.
Yeah. It's like my parents were like, you're not allowed to wear shorts. And I would like change clothes in my car and like go wear shorts at school. Yeah. Like everything they told me not to do, I was like, that's what I'm doing. Like, it's like you're giving me a list of what to do by saying you can't do it.
Because we live in America.
Yeah.
And it's like, if
the
you
first thing I did when I went to college at 18, I ate pepperoni just straight off of pizza before I stopped eating meat.
You
I was just like,
crazy.
I can finally eat pepperoni. I can finally eat like marshmallows. I'm gonna go all out.
Hold on. I need to call your mom.
In high school one time, I was really stoned. And I went to Wawa, which is this convenience store.
You're wearing,
I'm wearing a
sweater.
A Wawa hoodie. Yeah. Hell yeah. Sorry, I'm sponsored.
You got like $500 by saying their name on this podcast. Like every time you say their name.
I wish. They're giving me $2. But I went to this. You could order a hoagie, which is a sandwich on a touchscreen. And I would always order the same thing, but I accidentally ordered bacon. I like hit the bacon button because at the end they're like, do you want extra bacon for $1? And I accidentally hit it. So I ate half of this sandwich and realized that there was bacon in it and got so paranoid about like the condition of my soul.
Oh, no.
I called my mom and I was just really high and she didn't know that. But I was like, Mom, I just ate bacon. Like, what do I do? And she was like, it's okay. You'll be fine. Like, God doesn't care as long as you didn't intentionally do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just stuff like that where I was always doing the opposite of what they wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't want me to watch Comedy Central. Now I'm
a comic.
Now I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe they were designing me to be a comedian.
Yeah. Without them knowing it, like subconsciously.
Yeah. Subconsciously. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I did resent it and I did rebel. And when I went to Vermont, it was to, like...
Break free.
Break free, and, like, I didn't want to believe in God. I didn't want to like have that guilt and like carry that around.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like being raised with religion sometimes, like, you're so fearful. Like, I remember there was like this saying, like, if, because we have to take our shoes off when you go into the house, but if the shoe was upside down, you're like insulting God because it's facing the heavens. And I remember, like, late at night, I would get paranoid and go to the garage and just make sure all the shoes were up, like, were right side up. Because I was like, I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want my soul to go to hell. And, like, I feel like you're raised with this, like, just a fearful life. And, like, and I would, like, pray every night, like, hoping my family would be healthy and whatever. And, like, I think that's. And then when I was 12, I was like, I told my mom I didn't believe in God, and she started crying, and I was like, oh, this is something I have to keep to myself.
Yeah.
But then I never really found it again.
When I read the Quran, when I was very young, my mom gave me the Quran and said, check it out. See what you think.
Yeah.
Which I was like, okay. And then I read it, and then I, for a very long time, was afraid the jinn were coming. Like,
oh,
they
the
were
jinn?
I was,
oh,
if
my
I
God.
Closed my eyes, the jinn would swallow
jinn
me whole.
Jinn are terrifying.
That shit
I'm still
fucked
scared of jinn.
Me up. Yeah. And then one day my mom's like, why don't you sleep anymore? And I'm like, oh, why don't I sleep anymore? Because the jinn are literally around us. And my mom's like, oh boy, we should have probably talked about the Quran before I just set you loose
I'm
into
so
it.
I'm so curious about how other people imagine jinn in their mind. Because I have a very distinct shape.
You know, like,
in my head?
Predator? Mm-hmm. That's like what I saw.
Oh
like,
my
I was
God.
Like, that's what's coming for me if I close my eyes for a second.
Wow.
I was fucked up.
I was never scared of jinn because I was just scared of like what was it, scary in American culture. Mm. Scared of like being possessed.
Oh, really?
Like exorcism style?
Yes. Yeah, because that was
You thought you'd eat bacon and get possessed by the devil?
Yeah, basically. There
it's
was
like,
this
I
weird
a way into you.
Through bacon.
The Dajjal, do you know about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so like that's like Satan.
Yeah.
But there was some story that my mom told me about how when you sleep in past Fajr, which is like the early morning prayer, that the Dajjal is – God had at one point trapped him in a rock and he was – and tied his hands to like trap him. And he used his tongue and he licked the rock and eroded it slowly with his disgusting Satan tongue and then was able to get out of this rock and like – that's an analogy in some way for if you sleep in past the morning prayer,
God.
That you're like giving Dajjal the time that
to
he needs
free.
To lick free out of inside of you.
Oh my God, that's terrifying.
So I like my best friend Christian, I remember telling him about Dajjal in like second grade. And like he's like licking me in the morning.
Christian's like, you fucked.
No, my mom got a call from Christian's mom that was like, okay, so I don't know really much about your culture, but Christian came home and said that you
someone's
were
licking
telling
him?
Him that a man named Jamal has been,
oh my God.
Like licking him every morning at 3 a.m. And I'm just trying to figure out what's the reality of that, you know.
Imagine being her and just hearing like your kid be like, yeah, my friend Hobbit gets licked every morning.
The
by
devil,
Jamal.
His name is Jamal.
Like, what?
Exactly.
But now you identify as Muslim and you fast and you have a whole like episode series about like Muhammad's Ramadan diary. What's it, is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny. Me and my parents watch it when it comes out.
Aww.
And I think it's just so cool to see Ramadan like normalized that way because growing up I felt so weird having to fast in public school and like still having to do PE and my PE teachers were still like wouldn't really understand why like. Like, I had some teachers that were understanding, other ones that weren't. And, like, so I really love that you have done that with, like, your platform. But knowing that you, at one point, rebelled and, like, strayed so far, how did you end up coming back to it? Because I never did.
Yeah, I don't know. Ramadan was just always something that I could remove God from. Even in college, I think I fasted a couple times. Because I just thought, you know, it's about fasting, really. Mm-hmm. And
I would keep a post-it note with the times the sun set on my laptop in college.
It's hard to fast for Ramadan like by yourself in Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. It was something that I liked doing because it just would ground me, center me. Like it makes you realize how lucky you are to have food, basically. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. You like end the month being like, oh, okay, I'm very, very grateful for all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to really put God into it at all. You can just be like, oh, I'm doing this practice for my own belief system that I'm privileged or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was kind of the saving grace, was that even through rebelling and not reconsidering myself Muslim, I was still fasting because it was fun in a way. And then when I moved out to LA, I mean, I still wanted to be an atheist, and I wanted to not have the guilt of God existing, and I wanted to just drink mimosas and, and have anal sex once in a while.
I like how it jumps from having mimosas to having anal sex.
But, you know, I never did that, by the way. But I also...
Teach their own.
Teach their own, exactly. That's just for my mom.
Okay, okay, copy that.
That part.
She's like, what?
Jeff, come here.
She's like, Jeff, what is a mimosa? Some sort of anal bead. I continued fasting when I moved out here, even though I was like drinking and not being a God person. And it was something that I could tell people I was doing, and they'd be like, oh, that's cool. Because in LA, everyone's doing something.
Well, don't you get annoyed when people complain about Lent? Or like stupid shit where it's like, I can't eat this for a whole month. And it's like, try not eating water or food for a whole month. I get really annoyed. But
Lent is just giving one thing up, right?
Mm-hmm. And then there's something else. There's
I gave up cookies. Ugh.
But people complain. There's like one day of fasting for either for a Jewish holiday too. And
Yom Kippur.
They make a big deal about it. But like, no one makes a big deal about Ramadan. I don't know. Just like, it's harder. I want some respect.
Yeah, I'm
doing for so long.
My mom is so, God, she's so good at being Muslim. But she always, during Ramadan, she just has, like, it's like nothing's different. She's so just like, yeah, I woke up at 4 a.m., you know, I had my meal.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just waiting, you know, just doing my thing, no big deal. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you woke up at 4 a.m.? Like, yeah.
I think the thing that I learned the most.
What's weird about that?
Is like self control and like self, like I was capable of doing something I didn't think I could do. And that's, I think, what Ramadan taught me the most, is like, oh, this, I'm strong mentally. And I am, like, it is very, you feel very grateful at the end of it.
Yeah. It does make you stronger too, I think, mentally, to just go through that.
Yeah.
And every day it's hard.
Like, sometimes I'll be like, I'll be hungry during the day randomly, and I'll be like, not as bad as Ramadan. Like, you can get through this stupid day if you can get through Ramadan.
I know. When I'm hungry during the day, it just makes me be like, oh no, Ramadan's coming. Because it's just a tiny preview of what the actual fasting is like.
Yeah.
Just being a little, like, hangry in the middle of the day. You're like, oh, this is going to be so hard.
You know, my brother figured out how to beat the fast, because he fasted with my mom, because he converted to full Islam in prison, as you do.
Whoa.
But he, so he basically, he eats sundown, goes out all night, comes home at 4 a.m., eats with my mom, and then just sleeps all day. I mean, that's his fucking Ramadan.
I mean, that sounds like nice if you don't have anywhere to go.
Yeah, it's like, dude, get a life. But like, or well, I don't know if he always does that, but I've been at home
before. I feel like that's low-key cheating.
Where, yeah, I didn't say anything else. I can't. Sure, you're Muslim, but come on, man. Like, you're out all night at the club, like, and then you come home.
Is he drinking?
He doesn't really drink.
Uh-huh.
So,
but does he wake up for Fajr and the hood and everything?
I don't know. That's a good question. Huh. I'll ask him when I'm home for the holidays. Yeah. But I always was just like, Dad, how do you do it? And he's like, well, I just stay up all night. I come home, eat with mom in the morning when she's awake at 4 a.m, and then I just go to bed all day.
Wow.
And then, like, wake up in, like, the afternoon and then do it all
again. Have,
like,
2 hours of hunger. And you're like, oh, it's time to eat.
Oh, how convenient.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I kind of do that here. I kind of stay up all night.
Yeah.
If I'm not working, I can stay up till, like, 5 a.m. and then sleep till, like, 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then I only have to fast till 8.
No, that's not bad.
Yeah.
It's not that bad. But these are long fasting days, you know, when it's during the summer.
Yeah.
When it's during the winter. I remember when I was a kid, I would break my fast at like 5:30.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing.
Well, do you remember when you were a kid? I feel like you're this, because I was born in 90. And so when I was a kid, there was sometimes the Ramadan lined up with Christmas and like a winter holiday.
Yeah.
And so like there was like a year or two where Eid was like around the same time as like Christmas or whatever, so it was like almost like fun to fast, because it was like, I'm celebrating too, like 30 days of Ramadan. Yeah, but I don't know. But now it's even harder, because it's like the days are just getting longer and longer during that time of year.
Yeah. Well, pretty soon it'll be. It's gearing back, right? Isn't it in May now?
It's in May right now.
Currently in May, yeah.
Yeah, so it's almost like a couple more years, and it'll be like coming
it'll come
back.
Down.
Yeah,
I mean, come towards the end of the year again.
Yeah.
But I just mean in L.A., like, everyone's on some weird diet.
Oh, right.
So when you're fasting, people are like, oh, that's, I haven't heard of that one.
The Ramadan diet?
Like, exactly. Oh, you're fasting? I'm on paleo, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it wasn't as weird in L.A., I would say. Like, growing up, I felt weirder, but L.A. is just a more accepting environment for
everyone. Well, especially because before we started recording, you told me you were vegan, and I'm vegan, and I feel like it's so much easier to be vegan in this city.
Oh, yeah.
Than anywhere else.
It's crazy.
Also
I think
Philadelphia. Actually, vegan places.
Yeah, we did. We went there this summer, me and Anna, and we were really surprised and happy. I was happy because there were so many vegan options.
That was part of, like, the guru's whole thing was being vegetarian.
Mm. Okay.
Wasn't vegan, but it was – so I grew up vegetarian. And there was all the – in Chinatown in Philly, there were, like, 400% vegetarian Chinese restaurants.
Yeah. We went to one.
Yeah, we did.
What was it? Singapore?
Starts with an S, but
– it was, like, a flower name. Wasn't it, like, flowery? Like a
– oh.
We'll have to get back. I have the card at home.
Yeah.
Shoot, what is it?
It was so good.
Yeah, it's amazing,
it was
right?
So good.
Because it's not healthy.
But I mean, like,
it's like super indulgent.
But it's still so yummy. It's so yummy. Wait, I have a question. So when you ate bacon on accident, it wasn't just because it was not halal, it was because you had never eaten meat.
Yeah, I think that was my first meat.
Whoa.
One time I had a cheesesteak in high school when I was drunk. And I ate some chicken for sure. I worked at this Mexican restaurant, so I just would eat chicken.
Would you tell your parents?
No, I would hide it.
Yeah. What made you... But, like, you obviously still don't eat meat, and your parents probably don't eat meat either, right?
No. Yeah. I think my dad eats fish now.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Pescatarian.
Yeah, my mom's a pescatarian. I was raised mostly pescatarian.
Really?
Yeah.
Our diet in my family is so meat-heavy, like... kebabs and beef stew. Like, when we were younger, my mom would make the stew, and I remember giving all the meat to my sister, and she would give me all her potatoes. Like, I was never a meat eater. And then now all the dishes I like are like poor people dishes because they're all lentils and meat.
Yeah, I grew up on curry and lentils and dal and all that stuff.
Nice.
That was the best.
Yeah, that is really good. So your mom knew how to cook all that stuff? Or, like, was it just in the community center?
Yeah, exactly. Oh. There'd be like these big meals every night.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
It was great.
Does your mom cover her hair?
Cut?
Cover her hair.
Oh, cover. Yeah, she's always covered her hair.
Is that, were you ever like singled out in school because of that? Because I was when I was growing up.
No, I remember like being at the mall with my mom and being embarrassed and just wanting to go to like the Vans store and buy shoes. And like I needed her to pay for the shoes. So that was the price I paid was
having her come in with her covered hair.
Yeah, I just felt embarrassed. Like, people would look.
Yeah.
And when you're a kid, it's like every little thing hurts so much.
Yeah.
So people would just, I would just see kids laughing and just feel so shitty.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not the worst thing in the world, but.
I mean, I feel shitty about it now. Like, I remember my mom went through phases with covering her hair. She doesn't cover anymore, but, and her story is really crazy when it comes to that, too. But there was a phase where she would wear these, like, hats. Like, it was like a cap around her head. So it wasn't really a hijab. It was more like a cap that she would tuck her hair in. And then there was also a phase where she would wear these bandanas. And I saw a photo of her, like, 6 years ago. And I remember that she would wear these bandanas. And I started laughing because I was like, I forgot you were like this. Like, this was a phase in your life where you wore these bandanas on your head. And she was like, why are you laughing? You're so mean. And I'm like, what? She's like, this is a part of my life that is so, it was part of my growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I'm a bitch. Like, I'm the worst kid ever. But it's just, I feel like when it comes to women in Islam, there's a whole other element of what they have to go through. And I'm sure your mom had to figure that out, too. I don't know. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, I think it takes a lot of bravery to just be like, oh, now I'm going to look like this. Mm-hmm. And everyone's going to look at me whenever I'm out. Which is interesting because it's almost the opposite of what a hijab is supposed to do, which is make you like blend in and not
draw attention.
Not draw attention. But in America, it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's not sexual attention, but it's still like a weird type of attention that I imagine is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm proud of her for just never taking it off ever. She doesn't care. But she also is white and people don't really know what she is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do feel like when you see a white person, you're just more out of curiosity of like, oh, I wonder what their deal is.
My mom goes on a walk like every day in this in Haverford College, and she said some guy walked up to her and just was like, what are you? I was like, my wife and I walk here all the time and we see you and we need to know.
Jesus Christ.
And my mom's so nice. She was like, oh, I'm Muslim. They were like, I knew it. You know, they probably had some bet going.
What the hell?
So you owe me $300.
Because I bet she could look like, I don't know, really Jewish or something. I don't know what people think.
Well, a lot of religions have elements where the women are covering their hair. People don't realize that.
Yeah.
You know, like nuns or like traditional Jewish garb also is like you are modest about your hair.
Mm-hmm. Don't Hasidic Jews shave? Women shave and then they wear wigs?
Is that what they... Is that?
I have no idea.
That sounds familiar when you say it like that.
I had no idea that was
a
thing.
Yeah, I thought all Hasidic Jewish women are shaved.
Interesting. Fully we'll get back shaved. To you on that.
Yeah.
What are your
call
parents...
my people.
Yeah. What do your parents think of your comedy now?
They're very supportive. Like, as a career, they were worried about it because I dropped out of college. And Yeah. And then I was doing open mics and delivering pizza. And it was
in
just,
Vermont?
No. So, I went to Vermont for 2 years, studied film. Had, like, a heartbreak situation.
As you do.
As you do. And then I went to Temple University, and that was for production. But I had this whole... I had this whole scheme. So after my sophomore year at Vermont, I lived in New York for a couple months. And that's when I realized I was bad at stand-up. Because I would go and do all these open mics in New York, which are like, you know, merciless.
Yeah.
However you say that.
Just merciless.
Merciless. Yeah. Just terrible experiences. Like LA open mics are the same.
Yeah.
Bunch of comics sitting, watching, judging, waiting for their turn.
Right.
And it's not like... It's not really offensive because nobody's laughing because we're also used to hearing jokes. Mm-hmm. And it's just we're all practicing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you don't go to the batting cages and like go like, yeah, you got it, buddy. That's how I feel. It's just very we're all just working.
Right.
But back then when I thought I was good at comedy and I went and did these open mics and just bombed every night, these shitty open mics, luckily, that made me be like, oh, I have to work hard to get good. I didn't quit, which was lucky. But that's when I realized that I sucked at comedy.
And a big turn from your sixth grade self.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought I was good, and I was like, I can use this 10 minutes for the rest of my life, and I'll be really good.
Thanks, Dad.
All of a sudden, you're on Conan at 10. You're like, yeah.
I know. I mean, I felt like, anyway, I saw this program at Temple University at the film school to do a semester in Los Angeles. And my thought process was, I'm going to go to Temple University, go to LA for a semester, and then drop out of college and stay there and just focus on stand-up. And my parents won't be able to do anything about it.
Uh-huh.
'Cause I'll be so far away. And that's what I did. And then I dropped out of college, and I was instantly working at this pizza place, Lucifer's Pizza.
Oh, what?
That's really close
so
to my house.
Good.
Yeah. Lucifer's is so good. But to my mom.
You were the devil.
Yeah. Your son drops out of college.
And goes to work at a devil's pizza parlor.
Works at Lucifer's in Los Angeles.
Oh, my God.
And my main job was, like, handling the pork.
Wow.
I smelled like pork.
You sank low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who have you become?
Ironically... funny. So then, but then I just kind of continued doing open mics forever. Still do them.
Yeah. Yeah. And here you are.
And here I am.
Yeah.
Doing a podcast.
Yeah. You've made it. Jeez, sorry. I always thought this was going to fall on me. It was wobbling. Oh, boy. I'm like, here I am. And then I'm crushed and I'm gone forever.
There she went. Yeah.
Wow. Wait, how old were you when you ended up coming to LA then?
I was 21.
Oh.
Because I went on Birthright right before I came out here.
Oh, I want to know about your experience on Birthright. I have thoughts about Birthright.
Yeah, Birthright.
I heard it paints everything beautifully.
It's propaganda, in my opinion. But keep going.
When I was at Temple University, my roommate was like, you have to go on Birthright.
You're the only Muslim that's gone on Birthright, probably. You know that, right?
Maybe.
Do they know?
Definitely. Yeah.
Ooh, that's interesting.
My interview for Birthright was like, hey, I was raised Muslim, but my dad is Jewish.
And your last name is Weinberg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your mother has to be Jewish for you to be Jewish. But I was like, my dad's Jewish, so I know I'm not technically Jewish, but I am interested in exploring that side of... And they were probably like, oh, this is perfect.
Yeah, a perfect person.
We are going to knock that Islam right on at him.
Exactly. If we can convert a Muslim, that's huge. Yeah. That's amazing.
You would have much commission are you going to get on that?
Every pamphlet.
Exactly. Like,
just your face.
Can you imagine if the recruiter would get commission over for each convert that went through?
He's like, yeah, I made 10 grand off that one. Yeah.
So that was
a big get.
It was so easy for me to get in. And suddenly I'm going to Israel.
What are your parents think about that?
I forget what they thought initially. Because
Israel is a holy land.
I'm
sure my mom was like,
Jerusalem is like a very holy place for Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
Right.
I'm sure my mom thought, oh yeah, and also go to the Dome of the Rock, and also, you know, it's not just a Jewish place.
Yeah.
So I went, and it was interesting for me because before that, growing up in this community, I never really felt like I belonged to any real culture besides this weird niche specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt like, oh, I'm part of a big Muslim community.
Right.
Because it was a small Muslim community. And we were all weird Jewish Muslims.
Yeah.
And I never felt Jewish. I never felt Christian. I never had a thing. And that was also the guru's teachings were very much like, don't belong to anything.
Which is kind of nice. You know, like it's not nice in a way. It doesn't divide everybody.
It's perfect, but it's also the opposite of perfect because.
Then you feel like you're just floating around.
In a society that is divided,
right,
to not be part of anything, you feel very alone.
Yeah.
So when I went on Birthright, suddenly I was like having so much fun. I mean, it was amazing. This group that you go with, it's just like a bunch of Jews from your college and you don't know any of them, but you suddenly feel so close to all of them.
Right.
And you're going to the Dead Sea and you're going to Tel Aviv and... Everything's paid for and fun and beautiful. Yeah. And everyone's so accepting. And even you have to go on, there's soldiers that go with you that are your guides. Mm-hmm. And they at first were like, who is this weird Muslim kid? But once they heard my story and knew that it was harmless, everyone just like loved me because I was this weird thing.
You do your jokes. You do your stand-up set for
the holy war one.
We did a talent show. In Jerusalem, I think, and I did comedy there.
You love talent shows.
I love.
You're the
kid
of the talent show.
But I felt very Jewish. I suddenly was like, oh my god, I think I'm Jewish.
Right.
I don't know if I believe in like the religious aspects of it, but I was like, these are my people.
Uh-huh.
And I love being Jewish all of a sudden, which is exactly what you're supposed to feel.
Right.
When you're there.
Yeah.
Like, these are my people. This is where we belong. This is my place.
Isn't that kind of scary though?
I was completely brainwashed. And they show you, you know, the Jewish sides of the destruction from the war. And they show you, you know, beautiful, you go camping with the Bedouins. And
whoa.
It's just so fun, you know? And I got back and my parents, like, how was it? And I was like, I'm Jewish. And they were like, okay, so we should probably talk a little bit about the Palestine situation and what's going on. And
I'm Jewish.
They're like, what have we done?
But luckily after that, I went to LA for my internship and stayed out here. And this is a different Jewish desert, but it's one that is less religious and less brainwashy. And I'm really glad that I came out here after that and didn't go back to college where I would have probably joined the Jewish
student union. Jewish Federation.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Not saying being Jewish is bad, but like I definitely felt like.
Yeah. But Birthright, I have there's a lot of issues with Birthright, and it's very skewed and
it's mostly funded by Christians.
Is
Do you
it?
Know that?
No, I didn't
what?
Know
that.
Evangelical Christians are like the majority.
How does that make sense?
Because evangelical Christians believe that the apocalypse will happen in a Jewish state. It will begin in a Jewish state.
Okay.
So it's part of their journey and their purpose to create a Jewish state so that the apocalypse can happen, so that all those Jews will die in a fire.
Wow.
But for Jews, they're like, oh, yeah, give us that money.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting because, evangelicals paid for a Muslim to go on Birthright is technically what happened.
Yeah.
So you would
I truly think you're the only Muslim that's gone on Birthright. Probably. And it's because of your last name.
I considered it, trying to find a way through, because I was just curious more than anything. Also,
you can go on trips.
I just wanted to go to Israel. I can't go to Israel because I have an Iranian passport.
Oh, yeah.
I have no chance.
Because
I've been to Iran multiple times. Well, more than multiple times.
And they're not
going to
let me in because I'm Syrian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the Wailing Wall is literally a wall of a mosque. Like, it's all so... Once you're there, you're like, holy shit, this is all the same thing.
Yeah.
The Wailing Wall is literally a wall of the Dome of the Rock, which is the mosque that the Muslims visit when they go to Jerusalem, which is where Muhammad ascended to heaven on a winged beast and received the word of God.
Yeah.
And then
right
up the street is where Jesus was crucified.
Yeah.
It's
the street,
literally.
That's the best. And if you take a left here, and you'll see where Jesus was crucified.
Yeah. It's all there. So you're like, well, this is a...
See, that's
insane that just
see all
the
that.
Jews own this. Because
I want to see and experience
that. That's what I don't like about Birthright, is that it makes it, it capitalizes on it being a Jewish place. And it's like, this is where we are. No one else should be here. Like, I don't get free rights to go to see the Dome of the Rock because I'm Muslim. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I think my issue with Birthright is that it's so, it's
clicky.
It's just, it just encourages a culture of
Israel,
like, superiority.
Is
clicky. And I don't like that.
I mean, I think because of the Holocaust, it really is. I think Jews really feel like they need to be strong now,
right?
And like have a place, and they're able to like justify what's happening because of their history, which is 100% genocide and slavery.
Yeah.
Right. So. I mean, with that in mind, it's kind of easier to understand, I think.
Yeah, no, I get that.
Even though there's no, you know, you have to be accountable for
your
100%.
Actions, 100%.
Yeah. I went on Birthright, then I came to LA. Now
you're here.
Yeah.
Well, do you have anything, like, as far as stand-up goes and comedy, is there something that, like, stands out to you as, like, a moment where you're like, yeah, this is, like... I shouldn't give up. Like, this is something really cool that I'm proud of that I've done.
You'd be like, no.
No, I'm going to quit right after this.
I'm trying to think. I've had so many just terrible experiences.
Oh, okay.
But those are the things that make it better in a way. Like, I have recently been performing for, like, Muslim fundraising.
Oh, really?
Wow.
For Syrian refugees.
Oh, that's cool. So nice.
It's very cool, and I'm very lucky to do it. It's also a terrible environment for doing stand-up.
Yeah, I bet. They're like, what?
They're like, we don't want to laugh about this right now, dude.
Well, it's, like, in a ballroom at a Hyatt.
Right.
Somewhere. And circular tables, meaning half the audience is not looking at you. Yeah. All the lights are on, and there's a fundraiser, and then there's dinner, and then there's something else really sad, and then me.
And then
I have to follow, like, war footage, usually. Something
that's hard.
Awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I go up, and it's hard to do stand-up in that environment anyway, but Muslim audiences sometimes are, like, more conservative, so I've gotten notes that are like, you can't talk about marijuana, stuff like that, where people get offended if you
That's
just say 90% anything.
90% of your material.
Well, it's accountable for it. Yeah. I don't know. It's, those experiences, though, where I bomb in a Hyatt ballroom and I'm like, ugh, but it's so, it's still, and now I get to talk about that experience on stage. Like everything, every terrible experience I've had now, it's like,
it's a bit
part of,
yeah.
Or just my story when I think about my life.
Yeah.
Been at open mics where I've been attacked by homeless people.
What?
Yeah, just so many things like that.
I think my favorite character of yours is you did at Underbelly, which was a show I produce with some comedians, and it's like stand-ups do anything but stand-up, and you did a thing where you were like, I think you were there for this one. It was at the Virgil. You were the Jewish Muslim comedian, and you just did a bunch of jokes that were like,
"Oh, I'm half Jewish, half Muslim."
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was there for that.
It's such a, like, just weird, just almost dad joke type of jokes. That was my favorite thing.
It's funny because those are like the biggest laughs I think I've ever gotten.
Yeah,
is doing that character
because it's just so silly.
It's so silly, but the jokes are just very, like, it's like, I'm half Jewish, half Muslim. I'll hijack a plane, then I'll try to sell it.
Well, there's one about the Goodwill Bin Laden.
You understand
like
that you're the only person that can make that joke.
Oh, my nickname in high school is Osama Bargain Bin Laden.
So funny. But, like, you're the only person that can make that joke and not get in trouble.
The best part... Okay, I can incorporate that act, that bit into my stand-up. Once people know who I am,
right,
and I say, and they know that I'm actually Muslim and Jewish, and then they're like, "Oh, he's doing a character."
Yeah.
But at Underbelly, I remember doing that, just walking out and just being that character.
Yeah.
And people being offended.
Really?
Yeah, or just the laughs coming, but kind of reluctantly.
Uh-huh. They're like, "Should we laugh at this?"
People are like, "Oh, this is just a white guy. He looks Christian."
Yeah. And he has a red beard.
He has a red beard, and he's doing like very offensive stereotype jokes about Muslims and Jews, which to me, I love that they didn't get the premise and are just offended. I think it's so funny.
I thought that was truly one of the greatest things I've ever seen. It killed me.
It was really funny.
That's awesome.
I remember like cackling to the point where I'm like, "Oh, God, I mean, like, I'm being very loud. I'm being so loud."
You have a good laugh though for comedy shows. You have a really good like loud like guffaw.
Yeah, it's been years of watching comedy. Well, years of being the person in the back of the room while people are bombing, just laughing hysterically because I just enjoy laughing. It's
That's
fun.
Great.
Wow.
I like comedy.
But because you pass as white, do you feel
white.
Like do you feel strange about that when you're like around other Muslims at all? Like does it make you feel like even more of an outsider?
Well, not growing up, though, but obviously here when I go to the mosque, I feel
They just assume
that
there's a
few other white people. Yeah, they assume I'm like a hippie.
But you know, a lot of my cousins have red hair, and like they kind of look like you. Like a lot. It's just like my dad has blue eyes. Like people,
I was gonna say the red beard is more common.
Yeah.
Than right. That's
people
true.
People realize. Yeah. Like a lot of my Iranian family is very light skinned in Iran and have like blonde-ish to
red
hair.
There's no one look to us, is what I'm trying to say.
The only place where being white and having a Muslim name makes sense in America is prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that tweet recently of yours, and I was like,
"Oh yeah,
really
you
funny.
Tweet that."
Yeah.
You're the one
Sorry.
Place you really
Plugging
belong
my
is
no,
prison.
No, I like your tweets; they're very funny. I didn't mean to out you as that being already said. No.
Yeah, my brother had a very strong Muslim crew.
Yeah.
In prison, like those were his boys.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Are there Jewish gangs in prison?
I'm sure there are. Yes, I'm sure they become. I think you kind of turn even more so into religion while you're there because. The way I understand it, based off what my brother told me, is like you want to be with your group and you don't want any reason for your group to think you don't belong. Because then you get kind of like lost in the shuffle and you don't ever really want to be lost in the shuffle because then you could just anything. Like you need that group protection in a way. Like, you need to know that someone will always have your back because they're racist against another group of people. Like there's just that's the fucked up dynamic, you know?
You got to be pitted against something.
Yeah.
Strange.
But I think there are, and I think they lean sometimes. They'll like lean more into like being like towards more like Hasidic like culture, you know. Like I think they kind of lean in harder to their.
I think they do really
roots.
Well in prison.
I would.
Maybe they have talent shows there.
Oh, they would.
Oh, Jews.
Yeah, no, just talent shows in prison.
You would probably be a great prison stand-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, what gang? I mean, who would I identify with?
Well, that's the thing is you have your pick of the litter.
Yeah.
Like
you can
go
blend
in, there,
in.
You could be a white
be the
supremacist.
Spy, the mole.
You could be the Muslim crew. You could be in the Jewish crew.
Yeah.
You could just
you
be in the
do
normal
all,
white guy crew. You can be in the more the artistic crew. Because I had a friend who went to jail and he was like the artist of jail. Because he went in because he was a graffiti artist and they finally caught him. And he had to go in and he was the guy everyone came to make cards for their girlfriends and family members so that he had that level.
He
so he
purpose.
Was able to be like, oh, well, I'm the jail artist. So you can't fuck with me because all these other dudes will fuck you up because they need their
so you're gonna be the jail
Valentine
jester.
Cards made.
Jail jester.
Yeah. I would love that.
He's like, thought about it, like, you know what? Yeah.
That sounds like a perfect career.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's not a career, my dear. It's a career to go to prison.
Come on.
So, yeah, they feed you, they clothe you, they have a bed, you know? It can be worse.
It's true. My brother would always talk about how there was a comfort knowing he was going to prison. Like, it was like, all right, well, now I don't really have to do anything for like 2 or 3 years. Like,
right.
There's no, the pressure's done because I'm already in the jail. Like, it doesn't matter.
I'm not going to do something illegal. Be like, I'm going to go to jail.
They should put a podcast studio in every prison.
Oh, my God.
Well, there's that one show, Ear Hustle, where they have inmates.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Where That's they talk. Cool.
I want to hear a show by prisoners.
Yeah. I think it is by prisoners. I think so. Well, but I need to double. Dude, I've listened to one episode and I was like, God, these guys are intense. I was like, no thanks. Back to Comedy Bang Bang.
Yeah. Where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
On Twitter at Ahamed Weinberg.
And can you spell it for them?
AhamedWeinberg.
Perfect.
Yes.
And is there anything, because this is going to be released probably in
the new year.
In the new year. Is there anything coming up in the new year that you're excited about or any shows that we can plug? Or?
My show at the Lyric Hyperion every second Wednesday at 8 p.m. Repentance.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be doing Colbert. I don't know when.
That's amazing.
I mean, I know I'm recording it, but I don't know when it'll air.
But that's really cool.
Keep your eyes and ears.
My mom is going to lose her shit.
Cool. She's going to send you the link as if she
would. Yeah, yeah.
I know, Mom.
Like, he told me about it. That's so cool. I'm so proud of you.
Oh, thanks.
It really is, it's strange. People tell Anna and I when they're on the podcast sometimes, like, we had this like older Egyptian guy.
It's always older Middle Eastern men tell us they're
like,
proud of
they're
us.
They're like, oh, we're so proud of you. But like,
and I'm like, thank you, Dad.
Finally. But it is strange because I feel like when I see someone that like I can kind of relate to or like doing things that like I feel like I wanted to see when I was younger, I am like, there's like a proudness. Like, I'm just like, oh, I'm glad you exist. And so, yeah, I'm glad you exist.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
I'm glad you guys exist.
Thanks, man.
No. I'm glad you exist.
No, I'm glad you exist.
No, you and you.
And you.
All yous.
I'm glad I exist.
Oh, okay. Weird.
I'm a little let down now because I feel like you're not, I thought you were so unique, but now there's a whole community of you out there with like Muslim-y, Jewy
names. We're going to have to go Jewy.
But none of them are doing comedy.
Yeah. Word.
Yeah.
Wait, was that offensive? Should I cut that? Should I not have said?
Jewy's fine.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
I thought it was funny.
Sorry.
Because you said Muslim-y Jewy, and I was like, that's a funny way to say it. You know, they're kind of Muslim-y, kind of Jewy.
If anyone, well, is that because you keep killing them every time they try to do stand-up? You're like, I have to be the only one?
Yes.
You're like the Dexter of that community?
I have to go.
Anyway, you can follow us at EthnicallyAmb, A-M-B, on Twitter, and then EthnicallyAmbig, A-M-B-I-G, on Instagram. And...
Oh, I'm on Twitter at Anna Hosea.
And I'm on Twitter at ShiroHero666, ShiroHero. And on Instagram, it's just ShiroHero. But, if you like this episode, leave us a review and a 5-star rating, no less. Thank you very much. On iTunes or your podcast app or Facebook, it helps us a lot. And keep up with Ahamed, he's very funny. And I'm very glad, I really am.
Wow. Thanks, guys.
Keep it greasy, is that what you're saying?
I try to change it up every time.
All right, keep it fleecy.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.